Hello, hello, everyone. This is a new episode of the Balcony Podcast, the fifth episode. And this time I was really lucky to sit down with Shadman Shahid. He is a photographer and a teacher at the KABK. And actually, he was one of the reasons that I was doubting a bit to choose documentary or fiction. Because at the end of the first year at the KBK, we have to choose between one of these directions. And I knew that Shadman was going to teach the fiction class. And a few months earlier, he gave a lecture in which he showed photos that he took. And I remember looking at that, those images, and I was like, whoa. Yeah, they really touched me. And also his way of speaking, his softness, his... Yeah, I thought he would be a really... probably a really inspiring teacher to have. And in the end, I choose documentary. So he's not a teacher that I have. And I thought this podcast will be a good way to still get to know him. So, for anyone else who is interested, have a good time listening. You've been teaching now for a while.
Yeah,
KBK. Is it this your first year?
No, this is my second, almost third year.
Almost third year, okay.
So it's finishing second year.
And you were in the master before, the master photography in society, right?
Yes, I was, yeah. While I was in my second year of that program, I started teaching. So I graduated and then I'm still teaching.
How was that, this transformation from... Well, actually, It wasn't maybe a transformation. You were teaching and student at the same time.
It was interesting. I'm used to teaching, but I've been teaching for a while now. Like, I've been teaching other things like economics and maths before while I was studying. But this is a very different sort of environment. You have to play different roles. It's confusing for everyone involved, you know, my teachers and their colleagues. So you have to switch from one role to another, and so do they.
Within a day.
Yeah, within an hour. Yeah. Even, yeah, sometimes.
Did it make you look different to also your own project by teaching?
Of always. That's one of the reasons why I love teaching. I actually really, really enjoy teaching. Is because how much it helps me in my own project. It's a really good experience, because when you're teaching, you have to research more than anyone else, right? You have to look at a work from 14 different perspectives, because you have 14 students. And I think to be a good teacher, you really need to understand everyone's perspective separately, individually. And when you do that, you get to look at a theme or a work or a photography from multiple perspectives. And that can be really, really helpful most of the time. Sometimes it can be too many voices in your head. Like when you're doing your own work, you sort of get confused. At least I do get confused about what my direction is or what my perspective is, because...
You constantly can see how others interpret it.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. If you're in that mode, then it becomes very difficult. But overall, it's a very valuable experience, I think, in terms of research, in terms of understanding, thinking, experimenting. I think it helps a lot. Yeah.
Are you doing a project now beside teaching too?
Yeah, I'm working on a few projects, actually. But to be honest, I haven't made anything since I've graduated. So for 6-8 months now, I haven't made anything, which I'm totally fine with. I don't think it's a problem. I think that's one of the changes, major changes I had when I entered this program of MAPS, from becoming this constant maker to a more, slower thinker. I think that was a major shift, but I feel comfortable in this role right now of not making and thinking about what to make. But I am working on multiple projects. I'm working still on my project on the theme of hyperreality, which is called Chimera. So it's a cross-media project. There are multiple chapters in it. So I'm working on one of those chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a film, which I want to make with the help of AI. So it's a found footage film. It will be a CCTV. It's footage from CCTV.
What is CCTV?
The surveillance television. Like the camera, surveillance cameras. Oh. So you have open sources.
You can access this.
Yes, anyone can access this. Open source cameras. Yeah. There are a few websites that you can visit.
And open source cameras are all kind of public cameras.
Yeah, like in shops or in the streets, or there are websites that have open webcams, so people will open their webcam to the public
and really?
You can see that as well. Yeah. So I'm thinking about making a story about, let's say, isolation in general, about Corona and isolation.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to make it with collaborating with data collecting AI.
Mm-hmm.
Open source CCTV. I'm also working on my book of No Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm collaborating with my close colleague and friend, Walter. So we're making the book.
Is that Walter Costa?
Yeah, it's Walter Costa. You know him. Yeah.
Yeah, he was helping us with the
publication
last week. Yeah.
He's a brilliant man.
He's a hard worker.
Oh, definitely.
There's so much input to give. He is always going on and knowing things to add and to say and feedback. And it's super energetic.
Yeah, it's one of his many good qualities, I think, being super energetic. I think, but he's a very talented maker himself, I think. But when he looks at others' work, I think he takes it to another level. Like the way he comes up with ideas about other works that's not made by him, it's very impressive. So I'm looking forward to making that book with him as well.
Your research seems really like this documentary approach.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have quite a fictional output or expression.
Yeah. How do you mean?
For example, Another Day in Paradise, I felt it was this, in the way the text is written, mm-hmm. It's interviews with the people, it's very relatable, mm-hmm. in this way, and on the other side, the images are quite surreal and dreamy and poetic.
Uh-huh.
Is this really relatable text versus the images that set a certain atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I would agree with that. At least that's what I aim to do. I think I like to deal with very real things and topics and themes. But I don't find it myself as a viewer as impactful to look at something that's just represented. Just a representation of something. So I do hope to go beyond representation in my work. So not just to show something that's there and then that's it. That's mm-hmm. where it ends. Rather than that, I try to see what the environment is. So the immaterial as well. some mm-hmm. things that you don't really see, but you feel, or there's, you can sense internally. How do you, is it possible to communicate those information as well through photographs or not? So that's generally my aim. And I find that a docufictional narrative structure usually helps me find that balance between something that's grounded in reality together with something that's immaterial, and how they can sort of come together mm-hmm. in one place. And I feel docufictional way of storytelling helps me with that. Yeah.
We were mm-hmm. speaking before the podcast. We had yeah. a little talk on death, on the topic of death. It was yeah. quite
nice.
Yeah. Nice. And you were saying how you experience in Bangladesh a different way of dealing with death, and how mm-hmm. much more in Bangladesh it's seen as it's in a tradition to really take time for this and yeah. to really also expose it.
Yeah. And a communal experience.
And a communal experience.
Yeah.
Which comes across to me as also giving space for spiritual
mm-hmm.
Way of being.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think that the different way of dealing with spirituality is something that is visible in the photographs that you make?
I mean, in I do feel that difference, to be honest. In, if I may say it, in a very non-judgmental way, I often joke with one of my friends who comes from the south of Spain, who is also sort of used to this kind of life, and we joke about like how there's no magic in the Netherlands. It's as if all the magic has been sucked out by logic, which feels a bit strange for me coming from Bangladesh indeed. But I think your original question was if that affects how I tell stories or not. Right?
Yeah.
If the docufictional approach is something local or not. To be honest, this is the first time I'm facing this question, but I hope so, and I think so. I think you have a point there, because of how we tell stories about things that matter in life in Bangladesh is quite in a quite magical way. I think it always surpasses basic reality in a way. It's not told through numbers or facts or statements of sort, but through stories that you hear from your grandparents, and it's passed down from generations to generations. There are truths is kind of looked at very vaguely, even mm-hmm. if you look at our philosophers or our writers or our poets. Usually how we try to understand reality is not very straightforward. There are not simple answers in the philosophies of Lalon, mm-hmm. for example. There are more questions. And it's expressed in a very abstract, non-representational, non-logical manner. And the spirit is quite strong. There's a strong presence of the spirit in everyday life and in everyday conversation. It's always there. It's important to talk about your spirit and how your spirit is doing. It's not the mind, it's a different entity. And you would have those conversations with your parents as well. Like they don't just ask about your body and your health, but they also ask about how's your spirit doing. I think it's ingrained in our culture in a way, but I hadn't thought of it. I think it's not something I do intentionally or something that I plan to do, but it happens naturally.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you see it and point it out. Yeah.
And how is it for you then to be in the Netherlands where you don't get those questions as how is your spirit doing?
Yeah, well, I really like the Netherlands for many, many different reasons. I like living here mainly because of the people I'm surrounded by. They're extraordinary people, and people here in the, we share a lot of common interests and beliefs and ideologies, and I think that's how you feel at home, right? More than anything else. But in terms of the nature, it's very different. I mean, the weather is different. The lack of spirit is sometimes difficult to deal with. Yeah, it's not I don't think I blend in. I think I stand out. Like, not in a way that I look different or I come from a different background, but for me internally it's difficult for me to blend in with the environment, to feel one with it. I feel very isolated from the rest of the environment, really. Yeah, most often. But I can understand why. I was thinking about this the other day, about how the relationship with people here with nature and relationship with people in Bangladesh and nature has to be different, because nature is very unpredictable here. It's like it's snowing one day and then like 1 minute, and then it's sunny the other minute. And there's no order in terms of what you want to expect from nature. It's so unexpected that if you think of the floods or before, right? It's really, really unpredictable. And the only way to deal with that would be to be in control of nature. Right? Like, otherwise, if you acted the same way, if we acted the same way as nature did here, we would be completely crazy.
Yeah. Because, well, we wouldn't even be here if we wouldn't have...
Yeah.
Or if, you mean in Bangladesh, if you would...
No, here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, if we would here maybe let that happen.
Yeah.
Then we would not be here because it will be flooded. Yeah. Right?
There's a question of survival.
Yeah.
Physical and mental. Right? Because you can't act as the nature does, because it's too frantic here. It's too unpredictable. It's too chaotic. There's no way a human mind can copy and keep up with that.
Yeah.
But in Bangladesh, I guess it's more like the nature is more rigid. As in the first 3 months, you know when it's going to rain. And then it will stop. You know it's going to stop. You know when it's going to be sunny. And it's a little bit more predictable in a way. So that allows us to have a kind of natural schedule or, yeah.
And a trust.
And a trust, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's different, and it has to be different.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's just something I was thinking about
yesterday. Yeah, it's interesting because my boyfriend is from Estonia, and in some ways I recognize the thing you're saying to also what he's saying sometimes, because there is a lot more forest in Estonia, and it's in size it's the same as the Netherlands, but the population is only 1 million people, so yeah, it's a lot more space in terms of forests, and you can be walking around in nature for a day and you don't see anyone there.
Yeah.
Which is just not possible. And we talk about this sometimes, how he also notices those differences in it is a very controlled culture here as well. And of course this brings many benefits, and it's very efficient, and it's
design.
Design,
Like Dutch design is above, like way above any other form of design anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's a feat for humanity in a way, right? Like if you look at Dutch design, yeah.
But it's design on so many ways.
So many levels, yeah. Yeah.
Like also the nature, we design it, we control it, we give it certain fans and...
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Dutch photography, the more renowned Dutch photography, it has a very specific quality to it. And it's related to the space, to the system, to all of this adds to our collective subconscious in a way, right? And that reflects in our photographs. And really good, the really good photographers from the Netherlands, you will see there's a specific sort of way of looking at things and recording incidences, and the things that are interesting to Dutch photographers are quite unique, you know, like there's a very unique sort of way of looking.
Do you feel that photographs, when you show photographs here, are being seen differently here than whenever you show them in Bangladesh?
Oh yeah, for sure. And it, and that's normal, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what you expect.
In what way?
Well, I receive a lot of feedback that it's too violent for the audience here sometimes. Mm. It's too direct, or maybe it's too much to... It depends, right? Which kind of work am I showing? But I think the audience here is more sensitive to these sort of images that are, I don't know, for lack of better word, darker, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
That's the general sort of feedback I get from here. But also there's the reading of the image is very different in terms of how the audience reads the concept and how the questions that are raised in terms of aesthetical choices, they go beyond the surface, you know, in a way. I'm not saying that's not happening in Bangladesh, but if you're comparing mass audiences, if I showed my images in Bangladesh, the way the mass would react is very different from the way the mass would react here. And I use the word mass very, tentatively. I don't mean to put clump people together.
How do you show the mass? Or I don't also don't know the word. What is a good word?
Yeah, we have to find out a good word for it.
It quickly sounds down-looking.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, exactly. That's the issue. I mean, I don't mean it to be down-looking, and by its nature, it's not. Saying mass like now, because we think that being an individual is special. That's why mass goes kind of down. But we should find a new word, definitely.
People outside the art academy.
Yeah, people outside, people who don't
decide. The world, just the world, basically. We are very small bubble within the world.
Exactly,
But how do you expose your photographs outside the art world?
It depends, and it depends on the project, really, and what I'm trying to achieve through that project. It can be, so I could give you an example of, let's say, how I did it here was, instead of showing it in a museum, I used projections to project it on a wall that projects outside the museum. So people who are walking outside the museum can see it and not from inside the museum. So I did that in Netherlands for a museum. I showed the work Achna there. And I found that really, really rewarding because it's a more sort of raw unexpected experience for the viewer, because they didn't plan to go to the museum that mm-hmm. day. They were just walking by it, and then they see some work, and I think that's interesting.
With the project Another Day in Paradise, you worked, would you say, with the community?
Oh, yeah, for sure. There. Yeah.
How was it for you to work with a community in which you're not a part of yourself mm-hmm. beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to do that, and it's always a challenge. I try to see what connects us in a way. Like, even if I am an outsider in the Netherlands, I would come and try to see what are the similarities between us? What is it that we can reach a common ground with, you know? So if I enter a community like St. Martin's community, which is a very, very closed community, because it's an island. First of all, they're detached from the rest of the country. You have to go there by boat, otherwise there's no other way to reach that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very closed circle, and it's a very few amount of people. Everybody knows everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So to land there immediately, everybody, it's like a spider web, you know, like if something falls on the spider web, all aspects of it knows that something is there.
Yeah.
And I felt a little bit like that.
Nothing stays unnoticed.
No. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows about everything I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
which is like an episode from Twin Peaks or Twilight Zone or something. But once you start communicating with them and like talking to them, finding common grounds, involving them with the project, treating each other as humans and on different levels, you know, like you have to be known to the kids as well as teenagers, as well as working people, as well as like people in politics and people running the kitchens and the women, the fishermen. Everyone have their smaller groups as well, even though it's a small community. But I needed to go and connect to all different elements, mm-hmm. and all different types of people, all different stratas of people. I think that was a very important thing to do.
Was that before you started photographing at all?
Yeah, definitely. Whenever you go to, I think for me, and whenever I go to a new place which is different, I have to spend a lot of time. I'd like spending a lot of time just placing myself there and making people aware that this is the kind of person I am.
Yeah.
And they feel comfortable. It's like with any other living being, you know, like you just have to go and sit with mm-hmm. them for a while,
mm-hmm.
so that they can understand you, recognize you, and these are your traits.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start your project, I think. And then you can start talking about collaboration and seeing if they're interested. What can you do to help them? What can they do to help you? I think that's how collaboration works, yeah.
Yeah. I notice myself that I'm getting more also used to collaborating, how I before was a lot more thinking that I'm intruding, or that I'm felt too much like, oh, I need to take something there.
Mm-hmm.
And by practicing it more and relating differently to people, how I also start to notice that it's so much of giving and taking, mm-hmm. giving and taking from both sides, and how people are also happy to give something or want to be photographed, actually. And before KBK, I was way more insecure with mm-hmm. this, I think. And when I feel that, the other person feels that too.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, if you think about Like if you have this mentality of, oh, I'm just going to go there and take, it's not something you want to do. Or, but if that's how you feel about the experience, then you will, if you're a good person, you will feel guilty.
Yeah.
While you're there and it shows, and you will look fishy. And if you're not, then you're exploiting someone. And you would feel exploitative in a way. And that also hinders your work.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like this switch of mentality is crucial. That it's not, I'm not going there to take. Yeah. I think it's a give and take, constant give and take. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it has to be something on... that's agreed by both parties in a way. Like it can't be on your terms, it can't be on my terms. Like
mm-hmm.
if you give me this, I'm going to give you this. I mean, you can't decide that beforehand. You are not the one who should be deciding it. You should be asking, or if you should be open to different forms of giving, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because sometimes you just, in your head, you're imagining, oh, I'm going there, I'm telling their story, and that's already giving because that's what they need. But you are deciding all of that by yourself, and it doesn't really make sense. And a lot of it is your own projection and your own sort of moral and ethical scales that you're using to decide this. And sometimes the reality is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they don't need... what they need from you is their story being told. What they need is maybe like a hand in getting something from point A to point B, or they need someone they can talk to and you just sit there and listen, or they need someone who can go and speak to a person who's in power and tell them about their problems. And it's different sorts of needs they have. So if you can fulfill those needs, I think that's also good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a linear sort of, I'm taking pictures, telling your stories, your life will be better sort of give and take.
Yeah.
And you give me the pictures. It doesn't necessarily have to be that.
Yeah.
It can be a very human thing, and like photography can be a part of the whole, you know? Like this is something that's important to you,
mm-hmm.
but something else is important to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
To recognize that and be helpful with that is already good enough, I think. But you have to be sensitive to see like if someone is agreeing with you because they're in a situation to... Are they in a situation to deny you or not? Like, can they say no to you?
Mm.
If you're in a situation sometimes where you're being perceived as someone higher, unfortunately there are senses as like hierarchical structures in our mm-hmm. country, and sometimes that plays a big role, especially in our country. We have to be even more aware of it. Like, can this person say no to me? Then you have to be extra sensitive and look at their reactions and their mm-hmm. body languages and how they respond to an image, because sometimes they want to say no, but they can't because of how our culture is and how it's structured and stuff like that. So it's really, yeah.
So it comes with this responsibility,
yeah,
that it's not always as easy to read.
You remember this, I don't know if you were here still then, like we had this talk from a Canadian photographer about this girl who was addicted to heroin, and he was saying it was a collaboration and stuff.
Is this the studio photos?
There was like some used, studio photos.
Yeah, I remember some series
mm-hmm.
Was showed in a documentary class in which different people
mm-hmm.
who were addicted were taken from the street and put in a studio and put on fashion clothes.
Oh, no.
It's
a different one. So I'll just briefly explain the story. So he collaborated, in quotation marks, with this woman who's addicted to heroin and crack. And I don't know if you have any experience with addiction or not, but when you're addicted, if someone offers you money, there's nothing you would say no to, you know. I mean, there's no way you can say that, yeah, this was a collaboration and everything that you see, I took her permission. And then he says, I paid for her drugs as well.
No.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, just because she's saying yes, it doesn't automatically give you the right to show it, because she's in no position to say no.
There is so much more also than just the plain answer.
Yeah, exactly.
There should be more to read.
Which
is maybe not just in language.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just spoken, right? It's unspoken as well. Mm-hmm. To know your position in this relationship, you know? Not to... I'm sure, like, you would be aware that this person is not liking it, but still saying yes. I think we have, like, we all have that sensibility in us to understand it. So it's important not to exploit that as well.
Yeah.
Especially in my country, where... that the idea of hierarchy is very rigid and strong there, you know? Like, it's very
in hierarchy, in what way?
You know, like, if you have more money, if you come from a specific family, if you come from a specific religious caste, if religion, all of, like, the kind of work you do, all of that creates hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're poorer, if you're doing a job which is which doesn't require academia, you're already in a set in a hierarchy in a way, which is terrible. I'm not a supporter of that. So you have to acknowledge that even though you don't support it, the other person lives through it, lives by it. So you have to respect that and understand it, and then take decisions. I think here it's a little bit less complex. There's less hierarchy. I feel, in general, I don't see it in terms of, like, economics. I don't see people treating others higher than themselves just because they're richer.
You said it before that you feel that the photographs come across, I don't know the way you put it, but that's quite violent here. And I remember so clearly the first time I saw the image you took of the embryo, the abortion photograph, and the photograph of the blood being poured on the wall. And that is quite exposed. And also, some, maybe sounds weird, but there's comes some kind of relief looking to it, or like seeing things so painful and clearly and in your face. It gives so much sensation to it. One way photography can make stuff more beautiful and maybe polished and make reality a bit more
sanitized
than what it actually is, but some photographs I've seen from you, it does the opposite.
Yeah, I agree. But I think you also brought up the point of why I do that is because it's happening. It's not something I conjure up. It's something that happens. And specifically for this story, I was looking at family albums, the storytelling structures of family albums, and the historical value of family album also, together with the subject. So how I was telling the story was looking at the family album and recreating a family album that's more complete. So in terms of photography, I think the most sanitized, the most perfect utopic photographs are photographs from family albums, because you never show anything that went wrong in your life. You only have a collection of the best moments. Even if it was a terrible moment, you're forced to smile and you think it was the best moment.
So it reminds me of where we had this at home when I was growing up, this poster hanging on the wall. And it was saying, as long as we are together, we act like we're a normal family. And yeah. My parents were about to divorce at that time. Oh, and I remember looking at that poster and thinking how ironic that is. But that is a bit this similarity to the family album or like the fakeness that can come with it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a really good point that you make. And yeah, as a family in general, we sort of hide all our darkness, insecurities, or sort of everything that's murky in our psyche or in our history stays kind of hidden from the rest of the world and within the family. Right, it is this. That's the structure of the family. We don't want to share that with the outside world. In the outside world, it's always this is a perfect family. That's the projection we want to make. But with albums, even that continues. You know that's also carries on to the album itself. Like we only want to project the best moments. But now, even more than ever, we look at family albums as a source of history, you know?
Mm.
We look at archival images as a source of history. It's a history that was recorded. It's a personal history. It's not the grand narrative or the grand history that's presented in books or academia or it's not historical imagery. But it's a personal history that we give value to.
Mm-hmm.
It's remembered as truth. But at the same time, if we only see this as our source of history, then we would think that the entire human history was a utopic journey full of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing ever wrong that ever happened. So I was thinking about that, and then I thought I will tell this story in a docufictional way, so I'll make a docufictional family album, which tells a more sort of complete story, which doesn't exclude the darker histories of the family, the darker histories of the personal history.
It's also an story like that, which is full of pain. You mm-hmm. can't not... You cannot show pain in that.
Yeah.
That would also be towards her. In that mm-hmm. way, it's also a collaboration. You show her pain.
Yeah, yeah.
In the most painful way it is. And that's what the story is.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Thank you. Yeah, yeah, it does.
When do you decide to shoot color and when black and white?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I think for me, aesthetic comes second. I think the content drives my aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually what kind of content am I dealing with would determine what aesthetic I'm going to use for that story. So, for example, in Ajna, it's more about creating an inner world, and I think to use color that way allowed me to move further away from reality in a way, and that's the farthest from reality I think in terms of projects I've been. And in black and white, it's really setting, like I said before, thinking about the immaterial as well. Like to think about the mood and the feeling and what you sense, not just through your eyes, but also with other sense organs. And how do you translate that through aesthetics? And that's what determines like this decision. I think it's very limiting to follow one signature language, for me at least. I find it limiting. I think one of my constant, let's say, suggestions from some of my mentors would be to have a signature style, and that always refers back to aesthetics somehow, and that's really problematic, I think, for me, and it's very limiting in a way. If aesthetics drives your practice, then you can only speak about certain things and only in certain ways, and you miss out on other things. I think in terms of what I'm interested in more is different subject matters in different fields of study, and I'm curious about different aspects of the world and reality, and I think photography allows me to delve a little bit deeper into each of that, you know. And if I had a limited aesthetic, I think I would only have one way of telling a story, and mm-hmm. that's indeed quite limiting. Yeah,
I think also looking at your work, it seems also in the way the emotions go, the stories go, it's going in many ways. There is not one fixed story you try to tell, or mm-hmm. identity mm-hmm. you seem to hold on to. And when we talked with this pain, you know, mm-hmm. when the project is painful, it needs to expose pain.
Yeah.
When the project is with the island, another mm-hmm. day in paradise, it's about the island. It needs to show how to go with the flow, maybe, of the ocean, whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's something I think is really beautiful about the way you work, is that you go with what's needed for the project.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you're right about the island as well. Like, I use slow shutter and try to capture the wind in a way to get the moon. But yeah, that's nice of you to say. Thank you. I think it's got to do with a lot to do with the economics as well. I think it's the commercial aspect of photography we cannot ignore. It's easier for those who are using our images to have a predictable photographer.
Mm-hmm. You become a brand almost as a photographer.
Yeah, because from, let's say, from Hana, we will only see this, and we know what to expect. There's going to be no surprises. There's not going to be any. We know it's a tested formula that works. So keep doing the same.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of makes sense for them to do that economically until they're sucked out dry, you know, like...
You become a machine a bit.
Yeah. You're producing the same sort of thing over and over, and then you get sucked dry and left aside. And then the next person who's doing something interesting comes along, and then they're sucked dry. And then you're left with things that you didn't want to do in the first place. So that's also one of the reasons why I like teaching, is because... I don't have to worry about the economics of photography and mm-hmm. stories. I can just do whatever I want, whatever interests me. And that's a bit selfish maybe, but it's for good reasons. I don't want to be selfless for economics. Yeah.
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 Thank you very much. Yeah. I'm inspired.